Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Morning, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm doing all right. I'm doing all right. As you're aware, I have been... had a little flooding in my house this past week.
Sorry to hear that.
About 9 feet of water in the basement.
You know, when I was a kid growing up, when we moved from Orange to Livingston, my parents moved into this cute little house right at the bend of a river.
Mm-hmm.
That when it got really rainy, didn't bend anymore. And just went right through our house and picked up on the other side in a straight line. And I will never, ever in my life live in a house that floods again. And that's why I live on the third floor in Jersey City.
Yeah,
third floor walk-up.
We were honestly very fortunate. You know, when I said we had about 9 feet of water in the basement,
mm-hmm.
basement's like 9 feet, 1 inch high. So
glass well, that is half full for you.
So that was actually kind of fortunate. But, you know, in these types of situations, the normal thing that people will do for you, besides offering you to take a shower in their house, which is very nice, is they'll bring you food.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so people, neighbors and you know, friends are bringing food over, and they're always doing it so apologetically, like,
why
I'm sorry, it's just some, broccoli and gabadil. I'm sorry, it's...
What do you mean?
Everybody's intimidated because I own restaurants and I do the radio
that's
show.
Funny.
So everybody's so afraid to give me food that it's not going to be good enough for me. I haven't had heat for 3 days. I haven't showered in two.
That guy was looking good.
Thanks for the food.
It's
quit worrying about it.
It's funny, the reason that we're in restaurants, and we talked about this as college students, mm-hmm. Shortly thereafter, as we were deciding what we were going to do for a living. One of the reasons that we felt, and I don't know if you recall, I'm sure you do, we talked about, why we wanted to do what this restaurant thing for a living. And when we began to think of it, because both of us worked just to make money right after college and for me through college, in the restaurant business, and yeah, it's about being excellent, and that's part of what we do. But where this came from, where we decided that this was an okay profession to be in, was we talked about, is it a good profession? Does it do good? And it does. I think it does. It provides a sense of community, a place for people to come together. And I think when you have a flood or when there's a tragedy in your life and the neighbors bring over food,
mm-hmm.
that's great.
No.
I mean, that is what, it speaks to the place that food has in our society. You bring someone food.
Yeah, it was really nice, and like I said, I feel bad for people as they're bringing these things over to me because,
mm-hmm.
first of all, Francis and I have talked about this in a couple of other shows. You're entertaining somebody who's in the food business. You're entertaining somebody who's in the high-end marketplace. The first thing you should do, comfort food. Okay,
oh, yeah.
Keep it simple. Keep it straightforward.
Don't make me the souffle because I can make it better than you.
I mean, how many chefs do and simple.
Uh-huh.
How many chefs do I know that were White Castle fanatics because
sure.
it was just so opposite of what they did on a daily basis?
There are many nights when we finish, and fewer now that we're older, but still I know that the chef does it sometimes, and certainly a number of the top staff, the sommelier, after they finish working for 10 hours and serving these wonderful tasting menus paired with old wines and all this wonderful, where they go? Diner.
Yep.
Diner, burger, eggs.
To this day, bacon and eggs is one of my favorite meals in the world.
Especially
just
at 2 in the morning.
Simple, little bit of toast, bacon and eggs. That's it. What's more comforting than a simple, straightforward meal like that?
Let me talk to you about a meal that I had out at a restaurant. I was
okay.
up in, did some moving around up in Jersey City, and,
mm-hmm.
and I went out with my girlfriend Jennifer to just get something simple. At a local bar that's beautiful, and it's a tavern. Service was great, and the food is good, because in years past the food had been, not very good. But now the food is good. But I got a burger, and it was just good. It wasn't great. And I'll tell you one of the things that was very interesting, because we were talking about it. The burger was texturally right. It had enough fat in it.
Mm-hmm.
It was, it was medium rare. I like my burgers medium rare. And in some places you can't get a medium rare burger anymore. Longhorn Steakhouse.
But again, remember the rules. if they say you can't get it medium rare, you don't want it medium rare.
You don't want their burger medium rare.
Okay, so.
But what was interesting about this burger, and Jen said, what do you think? I said, well, it's very good, but it's, you know, it's supermarket beef. Mm-hmm. And she said, what do you mean? I said, it's supermarket beef. It's not too lean. It's the, you know, it's got enough fat, but it has no flavor at all.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely flavorless. And, you know, yes, it was juicy, but that juice itself had no sense of umami, which is the, that meaty taste,
mm-hmm.
which there are two things that go on in a burger. And I think too often we get burgers that are nothing but texture upon which you can put ketchup. And you know, I love ketchup, but that's what you had with this. And the other mistake they had made, and this is a mistake people make at home sometimes, when you melt a big, thick hunk of cheddar cheese on a burger,
mm-hmm.
don't melt it until that cheese disappears into the burger.
Right.
You want to leave it to the point where it's just about to melt. It's
mm-hmm.
you know, it goes away when you chew on it.
Right.
And because I say texturally, I couldn't taste the cheese.
Mm-hmm.
And the burger had no flavor at all. And you know, I knew one chef of ours who used to, in his private life, cheat, and he would throw duck fat in his cheeseburgers. Let me tell you, that was something else. But that's the point about buying good meat, and mm-hmm. it's not just the texture.
I was down in the Florida Keys just a couple weeks ago and went to kind of a nondescript little tiki bar on the beach and ordered a burger, and I was actually surprised at how good it was for exactly those reasons,
mm-hmm.
okay? The cheese was just the right texture. The quality of the meat was pretty good. And in our profession, in the restaurant business, there is more and more availability of good products. And, yeah, it's slightly more expensive to buy the good product instead of the kind of mass-produced product. But I'm very encouraged, and I think that it's become much easier to be a pretty good restaurant than it was 15 years ago when we opened Stage Left.
I agree. It's still just as easy to go out of business being a pretty good restaurant as it was many, many years ago.
Of course it is.
It's one thing the restaurant business is really good for.
But I'm encouraged by the level of quality product that is out there and the level of those small purveyors who are out there bringing. I mean, New Brunswick is an unfair example because there are lots of pretty good restaurants in a very small area.
Yeah.
So people are willing. There are purveyors that are willing to bring you almost anything because
sure.
they can probably sell it to two or three other people.
Mm-hmm.
But even in, you know, I'm in Key Colony Beach where I really didn't expect to find even mediocre food, certainly at on the beach, and it was a nice surprise.
I'm very happy for you. I don't know why I have this picture of you in a Speedo in my head, and it's really disturbing.
Put it away.
Okay.
Put it away. Put it in the vault.
When we come back from the break, we're going to be talking with Wayne Curtis about his book And a Bottle of Rum, A History of the New World in 10 Cocktails. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. And our guest today is Wayne Curtis. Wayne, his stories on travel and architecture and history have appeared in the New York Times, the Atlantic Monthly, the American Scholar, and American Heritage. He joins us today to talk about his book, And a Bottle of Rum, A History of the New World in 10 Cocktails. Well, yo-ho-ho, Wayne, and welcome to the show.
Well, pleasure to be here.
So, Wayne, why a book about rum? Scotch, vodka, bourbon, not interesting enough for you?
No, actually, they're not. rum, I think, has got a lot more history to it and a lot of history that just hasn't been discovered, at least not until recently. You know, rum is really the American drink. It's the American spirit. If you went into a tavern in 1750 and asked for a liquor, you would have gotten rum. Bourbon didn't come around until later, and the other imports really didn't come until later either.
So if I asked
for, I just thought it was a story that hadn't been told.
If I asked for a Cosmopolitan, I'd have gotten beat up.
You would have been shown the door.
So now, I remember one of my favorite musicals that I saw in 1976 was the musical 1776, and there's that famous song in it, Molasses to Rum to Slaves.
Right.
What was that song about?
It was about the triangle trade, and it probably did more to cement in the popular imagination the presence of the triangular trade than anything else. They went, starting in the, well, around 1880, the idea of the triangle trade started, which was that the New England colonies really made all of their money on illicit or immoral industry, which is that they exported rum that they made to Africa, and there they traded the rum for slaves. The slaves went to the Caribbean, where it was traded for molasses, and the molasses was exported back up to New England colonies to be made into rum, and it was sort of this nefarious clockwork that kept the entire New England economy going. The problem with it was it's not really true. There was some of this trade going on, but it wasn't nearly as widespread and economically as important as we'd come to believe, thanks to the Broadway musical and others.
See, Wayne, I thought you were going to say the problem was that there was slavery. I see. That was, for me, that was what I thought the problem was.
Well, I have to say, this stuff is fascinating. Although I still do like the musical and I still do like the song, it's good to know that it's untrue, because I actually didn't know that. But why was rum historically so important, other than that it kept Americans, well, gave us the opportunity to get drunk? I mean, why was it so important? In what ways was it important in our history?
Early on, it was really our first major domestic manufacturing industry. It was second only in importance to shipbuilding. Shipbuilding obviously was huge, particularly on the Northeast Coast. But after that, it was rum manufacture. It really helped build up the colonies. They could get really cheap molasses from the West Indies, because molasses is basically a byproduct of sugar production, and it was just being thrown into the ocean in many cases from the sugar plantations. So they could ship that up for nothing and make rum out of it and make some significant cash. There were about around 1750, probably 160 rum distilleries in New England alone. They were all up and down the coast. There were some in several in New Jersey, Philadelphia. There was a distiller named Peacock Bigger who had a distillery in Philadelphia, also in Delaware, making rum. So it was widespread. It really was one of our first major manufacturing industries right up to the Revolution.
So now, I mean, we don't think of quality rum as coming from the United States. We think of quality rum as coming from the islands, Barbados, Martinique. It's illegal in the United States, but Havana Club from Cuba is a wonderful rum. When did the rum industry leave America?
Started disappearing shortly after the American Revolution. There were a number of things happened to it. The trade with the West Indies became much more problematic, since they were no longer fellow colonies. They were now a different nation. But the more important thing that happened was that as the America moved west and crossed the Appalachians and started settling in Pennsylvania and Kentucky and Indiana, they started producing huge amounts of corn and wheat, and that could be converted to whiskey. In fact, it had to be converted to whiskey. It was utterly uneconomical to ship those things back, the grains and the corn back to the East Coast, because there were no canals at that time, there were no railroads. So a horse could take about four bushels of wheat, but it could take the equivalent of 24 bushels of wheat if it was converted to whiskey. So a lot of the farms in the Midwest started producing whiskey and shipping it east, and that's when whiskey really took off, 1800, 1825 in that era, and displaced rum. So rum just faded from the landscape for quite a while, right up to about Prohibition.
Well, and let's face it, rum whiskey is a heck of a lot more fun than corn anyway.
no doubt.
Well, when we come back, I want to talk about the difference in sort of rum as a commodity and quality rum in the state of rum today, because there are some amazing rums being produced today, and it's really seeing a resurgence in this country and what you can find locally. We'll be back in just a minute talking with Wayne Curtis about his book, And a Bottle of Rum, A History of the New World in 10 Cocktails. Central Jersey, 1450, time is 1124.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were, you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or catherinelombardi.com. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys, on Central Jersey 1450. We're talking with Wayne Curtis about his book, And a Bottle of Rum, A History of the New World in 10 Cocktails, which you can purchase. You can go through our website, restaurantguysradio.com, and we'll link you right up there. Now, Wayne, history is important and all, but happy hour's coming. So let's talk about rum today. Okay. Talk to me about the kind of quality rums that people can find in the upper-end establishments. I'm not talking about your... You know, not that industrial rum, like, you know, your average bottle of Bacardi doesn't have a place in the world, and we'll talk about that in the second part of the show. But talk to me about the quality rums that you can find today.
Well, there's it's really exploding. It's that whole end of the rum market is the one that's really driving the industry now. I think it was up 30, number of super premium rum sales were up 32% last year. It's there's great stuff out there, and by great, it often means aged. There's now some of the stuff that's been sitting in the barrel for a while and it's coming onto the market. And it's really, I think, surprising a lot of people who may not have had rum since that unfortunate encounter with the shrubberies after the high school prom.
So what happens to rum when it's aged? I'm sorry to interject there, but just we'll get back to the... What happens to rum when it ages?
A number of things. It's a really complex bunch of interactions in oak that take place. I won't get into them too much, but basically it takes the burrs off the harsh rum, and it allows, just as with bourbon, allows the oak to really season the rum. A barrel that's been charred has got a lot of natural vanilla and flavors to it, some cinnamon and caramel, and that gets infused into the rum as it sits into the barrel. You can really taste it deepening and richening as it ages. The downside is if it ages too long, it tastes like you're licking a piece of wet wood, which unfortunately a number of rums seem to have equated 15 years in a barrel with quality, when 15 years in a barrel might mean wood taste.
Well,
now,
5 years is good, 10 years is better, and 15 years is
well,
best, right?
Well, there's amazing rums at 23 years, but what they do, there's all sorts of different systems. You know, there's the Solera system where they top off each barrel for each year with rum from the previous year, so they keep it filled up. And it managed to sort of dilute it bit by bit, so it keeps some of the woody taste out. I'm thinking particularly there's a rum out of Guatemala called Zacapa, which is aged 23 years. It's really extraordinary, and it's a great rum to offer someone who hasn't had anything but a little unaged white rum.
Well, now that brings us to a good point. If somebody wanted to go out today and they wanted to, and they were, of course, over 21 and wanted to responsibly try some of these high-end rums that we're talking about today, what would be some rums that they might go into a great liquor store and ask for?
Well, at the Guatemalan, there's two. There's a 15-year called Zaya. Those two are high on my list. I just recently had one from the Dominican Republic called Ron Barcelo, an aged rum, which is really extraordinary. It's very much like, it's got the richness of the Guatemalan rums, but without the sweetness to it. And there's also now available in the U.S. more and more Martinique rums, which have really been underappreciated. They've been sold widely in France, since Martinique is still part of France, but just recently have they come into the U.S., and there's JM, Clément, Nissan. These are all Martinique rums, and they're very different than the rums that you would get from a British or Spanish island. Real different flavor profile.
I remember having a bottle of I think it was vintage dated JM rum at a high end restaurant in Paris way back when ironically they brought over, and I guess not ironically but unusual in the United States, they brought over, we had a rum baba course, and they brought over a garadon of selection of rums.
Rum baba is a dessert that's made with rum tableside.
It was spectacular.
Well. Hey, we're going to go to the news, Wayne, but I'm hoping you'll stay with us over the news, and I'm hoping when we come back you will tell us the story of Captain Morgan the man, and then maybe Captain Morgan the rum.
We'll do that.
All right, after the news, you have to come back to us so we can hear about Captain Morgan, a privateer, and a colorful rum label. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1130.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey, 1450. WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon, reach us through restaurantguysradio.com, or download our podcast on iTunes.
Wayne Curtis's stories on travel, architecture, and history have appeared in the New York Times, the Atlantic Monthly, American Scholar, and American Heritage. He joins us today. We're talking about his book, And a Bottle of Rum, A History of the New World in 10 Cocktails. When we promised the listeners before the news break that we would talk about Captain Morgan. He's not just a rum brand. There was a Captain Morgan,
there,
right?
There actually was a Captain Morgan, and he was nasty.
What was S-O-B. He spicy?
What's that?
Was he spicy?
He was much spicier than the rum, actually. He was a really nasty guy. And it was probably the most famous of the pirates or privateers cruising the Caribbean in the 1600s, famous for taking the city of Panama with a small crew of people. How he got associated with rum, I'm not exactly sure. They were, when they raided the villages, there wasn't all that much rum. They were really out and about prior to the highlight of the rum years. And according to the accounts contemporary, they drank a lot of wine because that's what they found. There was a lot of Spanish wine they were capturing, so they drank it. It was only later that when he retired that he to Jamaica, he sort of drank himself to death on rum, which was then pretty easily obtained. You don't hear that much in the marketing materials on Captain Morgan rum.
Can I ask you just a little sidebar for a second? What's the difference between a privateer and a pirate?
One had a hall pass from the principal. he got a letter from the king or queen saying it was okay to go ransack and pillage. You were a privateer. If you didn't, you were a pirate. And there was a fairly blurry line between the two.
Well, but if you got a note from the British queen, you couldn't ransack and pillage British villages.
No. You'd then go after the Dutch or Spanish or whichever ones they happened to be at war with at the time.
So when you said he was nasty, like what kind of nasty things did he do?
Oh, well, strung people up by their testicles until they were separated from them. A lot of burning and torturing of people while they were alive. That's when they showed up in these villages, that's what they did to find out where the gold was buried, which usually the sensible villagers would do. So they'd torture until they could get someone to reveal it. And often it was successful.
And he looks like such a nice guy on the bottle there. He's always smiling.
You know, the Captain Morgan rum has been around since 1953. It actually wasn't spiced originally. It was just a light blend, sort of chasing after the vodka market. And it was in the 1980s it was reformulated and spiced. And it's really a huge phenomenon. It's a massive bestseller and really popular. And no one can really explain why.
I was going to say, how does it rate as far as rums are concerned?
It's very efficient in getting you drunk.
It is what we call in the business an ADS, an alcohol delivery system.
It is. It's a very efficient one.
So talk to us about, I read recently that you were at Rum Jungle in Vegas, which is
right.
Maybe the best collection of rums or one of the best collection of rums available to the public in the country. What was your experience like there, and what are they doing with rums down there?
It was disappointing. I liked sitting at the bar and looking up at this 30-foot high wall of rums that was backlit. It was a beautiful sight, and it was great to just sort of look through the rums. But I don't think they've done much training there with their bartending staff. When I asked for a classic cocktail made with one of their rums that they had, the guy really didn't know what a classic cocktail was and had to be coached through it. And you look at their menu, and they offer flights so you can try four or five samples, but it's like Bacardi flavored rums, and I mean, there's really no reason to be sampling Bacardi flavored rums.
That's like going to a great beer hall, like this was one of the best beer places in the country, and they're like, okay, here's your flight: Pabst, Rheingold,
yeah, exactly.
Colt 45, and Bud.
Exactly.
Is rum and Coke classic? Is that?
Oh, it is. Rum and Coke is a classic, but a different kind of classic. You know, it dates back to 1890s, but it really took off during World War II when the Andrews Sisters gave it all of its free marketing with their hit song. Third best-selling song of the 40s.
What song was that?
Rum and Coca-Cola.
Oh, drinking rum and Coca-Cola. My dad had that.
Yeah.
Now, what is the history of rum and Coke, and why is it called a Cuba Libre?
That's a matter of some debate, but the history is fairly simple. Coke started exporting in the late 1800s, or didn't export. They actually set up factories abroad. The first two places they went into were Germany and Cuba. And it's no surprise that somebody thought to mix rum with Coke, especially since a lot of the rum available in Cuba was designed, for the agricultural laborers who didn't have much money, and so they would mix anything they could with it. And rum and coke, when coke was available, they found, hey, that mixed pretty well. Why it became a Cuba Libre, and basically the difference between a rum and coke and a Cuba Libre is adding a wedge of lime to it. There's a lot of speculation about that, but probably dating back to the War of Spanish Independence, 1898, when the Americans were there. The one story you hear a lot is that some Americans at a bar tried it with lime because somebody else was doing it, and they thought it was so good they decided to toast to a free Cuba. So it, a lot of people seem to think it somehow is related to Castro, but it way predates him.
Interesting. You're just a font of historical knowledge. I love
all
this.
Useless.
Okay. Not to an alcoholic like me.
You're talking about rum. Hold on a second here.
Now, here's another question for you. Now, we've talked to people who make fine wine and fine brandy. You won't find a French producer of cognac who says, yeah, I went into the bar and I loved their selection of old French cognacs, and so I asked them to mix it up and make me a cocktail with it. Is rum to be drunk, these fine rums, are they to be drunk straight, or can you put almost any rum into a cocktail?
You can put almost any rum into a cocktail. Some of them, I love to drink straight. I feel somehow it's wasteful to mix it. The Zacapa 23-year-old from Guatemala is a case in point. It astounds me that Zacapa, the marketing people out of Florida, have been trying to promote it in mojitos. And I'm thinking, why? Why would
right,
you do that? Yes, it's a great mojito, but I'm not sure if it's worth doing that. But other rums mix really well, and even a really fine rum. One of the more interesting things that came out in the research, I have a chapter on the tiki movement, started basically in 1938 and continues to this day. But the early tiki drinks were absolutely outstanding. I mean, and they were made with really good rums. I mean, the first Mai Tai was made with 17-year-old Ray and Nephew rum and another rum, I believe it was Myers. And these were outstanding rums that they were mixing in there. And a lot of the tiki drinks now, you go to these sort of retro tiki bars, and it's just like, we'll throw some cheap rum and fruit juice in a glass, and we stick an umbrella on it, and everybody's happy. And these are nasty drinks. But, I mean, the original tiki drinks, if you start doing the research, and there's a few places on the West Coast that are very serious about reproducing the original tiki drinks, they're outstanding.
I guess you should clarify a little bit what a tiki bar is.
Tiki bar, those were popular. I think they were, well, they were definitely nationwide. I grew up in New Jersey, and I remember, I think, seeing one in Scotch Plains that we used to go to from time to time. But they were the Polynesian restaurants. They appeared most popular. They became most popular in the late 1940s and early 50s after the soldiers were returning back from the South Pacific. The thatched roof huts, the hula girls, the flaming drinks, the food with brown sugar and pineapple in it. It was a real craze for a long time. They really faded in the 70s. A few held on. But the drinks were a whole part of that subculture, and it's sort of been underappreciated until recently.
Well, I'll tell you, you talk about sometimes the retro misses what the first thing was. I was talking earlier in the show about, I was in the Keys just a few weeks ago, and I went to like one of these little beachside tiki bars, except they served pizza and burgers. And I thought...
Was it pineapple pizza?
No, it was not.
Kind of tiki Italiano.
And I thought to myself, I think you missed it. And the other thing they did that really bothered me a little bit, they had one of those like frozen drink machines that have kind of become ubiquitous, and they made it with like this kind of strawberry sludge that came out of a quart container, and that was the mixer. It was really gross.
Yeah, it's a shame what's happened. I think the daiquiri is a real tragedy. But one of the things that fascinated me in the book was that Ernest Hemingway was famous for his daiquiri consumption. He had his own stool at his own favorite bar in Havana, and he just sucked them down there. And I started thinking, daiquiris, they're sort of a girly drink. What was Ernest Hemingway doing drinking those? And if you do a little research and found out that how they evolved into a girly drink, and it really happened around 1937 when the Waring blender was introduced, and it sort of took off at bars, and Instead of being a really nicely handcrafted cocktail, which the daiquiri originally was, a nicely balanced drink, it took a lot of skill to make it, it just became basically sherbet that got you drunk. And,
well,
it's gotten worse and worse.
Well, as sherbet goes, I like it. As cocktails go, I don't.
Sherbet should not give you a hangover.
I don't know. I don't like sherbet except for the kind that does, maybe. When we come back, we'll talk to you about a Hemingway daiquiri. We actually make a Hemingway daiquiri at Catherine Lombardi's bar, which is the old-style daiquiri, and we'll tell you how you can make one at home. And we'll also talk about the evolution of the daiquiri and the pina colada. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45.
Let me talk to you about lighting, and specifically about how you can enhance the appeal of any space. Lighting is a powerful, emotional, and aesthetic force. It's one of the most important elements of design. More than anything else, it sets the mood and tone for an entire experience. A room pops or it doesn't based on lighting. Lights on 9 is a top-notch commercial and retail lighting supplier. Lights on 9 supplied all the lights for our award-winning Catherine Lombardi restaurant, inside and out, dining room and kitchen. Lights on 9 has everything from tasteful and stylish chandeliers to table and floor lamps to outdoor lighting for illuminating a building or walkway or a sign. At Lights on 9, the service is exemplary, expert, and knowledgeable. They ship anywhere in the continental United States for free. Their retail store is in the Galleria Shopping Center on Route 9 in Manalapan. They're open 7 days a week. Call them at 732-308-9166. That's 732-308-9166. Or visit them at lightson9.com. That's lightson9.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi. And we're talking with Wayne Curtis about his book, And a Bottle of Rum, A History of the New World in 10 Cocktails, which you can find out more about and even order if you want on our websites just in time for Summer of the Beach and Cocktails. You know, Wayne, I like pina coladas and getting caught in the rain. I'm not into yoga. I'm into champagne. What about the pina colada?
I don't give much attention to the pina colada in the book. I think... Well, I like a drink that actually highlights the taste of rum, and a pina colada seems to be designed to mask it. It's, you know, that Coco Lopez and the pineapple juice are really like linebackers. They just flatten anything that gets in their way. So a pina colada is also good rums with, but you don't need to use a fancy rum with that one at all.
Well, then let's talk about your book is entitled A History of the World in 10 Cocktails. Why did you choose the cocktails you chose, and why don't you talk to us about one of them?
Well, the cocktails are each represent an era to me. When I was researching rum, I was just fascinated by the fact that it had persisted and sort of transmogrified so often. I started researching, and I found that each era really had a rum drink that encapsulated it nicely. Right from the 1640s, when it really first started appearing, which when it was called Kill Devil, that was the original term for rum.
Good name.
Right up to the mojito that we're seeing so popular, that's so popular today. The one that a colonial drink, was Flip, which really fascinated me, which was made with a heavy beer, something like a Guinness. And rum was put into that, and then a sweetener was added to it. It was either molasses or dried pumpkin, something like that. And then what you do is you put a loggerhead into it. Now, a loggerhead was a piece of steel with a bulb on the end of it. It was heated up so it was red hot in a fireplace. Then you thrust it into the tankard with that mix in it. It would just bubble up and burn and roast. I read quite a bit. It was very popular for about 100 years.
I can't imagine why the dried pumpkin beer molasses loggerhead steaming steel isn't popular anymore.
Not popular yet. It's coming back. I'm telling you.
What's old is what's new again.
I had an ironmonger make me a loggerhead, and I spent quite a bit of time experimenting with this. And it actually is not bad. If you like Starbucks coffee, that burn taste, I think something about the loggerhead and the grains in the beer burn nicely, and it fuses together, and it's actually not bad.
Okay, you know you got a problem because you had an ironmonger make you a loggerhead. Okay,
and it's true.
And you know how we have a problem? After the show, we're going to talk about how we can borrow that from you.
One nice bit of trivia: the word, when you hear the phrase "at loggerheads," that's what they used to fight with in taverns. So,
really?
Yeah, they'd have them in the fireplace, and they would start drinking a little too much, whacking at each other. They'd grab a loggerhead, and it's probably an ugly scene, but sort of a little ghostly remains of rum every time you hear that phrase.
So has rum always been mixed? Has there always been a cocktail? So in the 1640s, what do they mix it with? What do they mix their Kill Devil with?
their stomach. They pretty much just shot it back. There's lots of accounts of mixing. It goes way back. People seem to think cocktails really started with Jerry Thomas in the 1860s, but the colonials were really creative with mixing. Punch has been huge forever. I mean, you can see accounts of that dating way back. It's from the Hindu word panch, meaning five. There were originally five ingredients in it. It was an Indian thing. It was made with arak, sort of a palm sap spirit, sometimes made with sugar cane. But basically, the goal was to mask the taste of the liquor because it was pretty nasty.
Yeah, I remember it from the late 70s.
Yeah.
Well,
1670s?
Let me ask you. You mentioned Jerry Thomas, who is, of course, kind of the most important, one of the most important bartenders ever.
Patron saint of bars.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, but let's talk about a drink that you write about somewhat called the Tom and Jerry.
Yes, the Tom and Jerry is supposedly named after Jerry Thomas. Nobody's quite sure whether that's the case on that or not. But that's a winter drink. It's sort of a creamy tasting rum drink. I don't have the recipe right here, but
it's already on our website. Anybody who wants to see it can get it.
Excellent. It was like Flip. It was extremely popular. I think the whole era of the warm drink has faded somewhat. People are associated with ice, and really Jerry Thomas's rise took off with the availability of manufactured ice. I mean, the whole cocktail culture really changed. So there's something to be said for cocktails really starting in the late 19th century. But the warm drink, like the Tom and Jerry or the Flip, it was something you could easily get at a bar, a rum toddy, something like that, made with rum and hot water mixed with some other ingredients.
Or a hot buttered rum.
Hot buttered rum, exactly.
You can get it, not anymore, but in season you can get it at our place. You can also get it at the Pegu Club in Manhattan. They make a great hot buttered rum.
Do you offer Tom and Jerry?
We do.
Only when it's cold.
Yeah. How do you make it?
We make a batter. We make a base batter that we keep in the fridge, and then when you order the drink, and the batter has a little bit of liquor in it to stabilize it, but it's basically eggs and sugar and spices, and then we put the batter in the glass, and then we pour hot water over the top, and we froth it up and finish it with fresh grated nutmeg.
Eggs and cocktails. You don't hear much about the poultry cocktails these days.
You know, it's funny. We use eggs in a lot of our cocktails and all of our sours and it's as do, you know, places like the Pegu Club in Manhattan,
right,
and Milk and Honey in Manhattan.
Yeah,
and
it's good to see that. And do you have any concerns about using the egg white in that?
No. I mean, you know, it's funny. We use them we pour the egg white right into the liquor most of the time, and we also coddle the eggs very often. And, you know, it's funny. In all the great cocktail bars, you've seen people use eggs. And once in a while, people will make note of it. But, I mean, if you want a frothy drink, that's the way to do it.
And one of the things I think that's underappreciated, a great bartender has to learn cleanliness techniques the same way a great chef has to learn, you know, what can go with what and how often you should be washing your hands and what you've just touched and what you're going to touch.
I think that was one of the great tragedies of Prohibition, is that really a lot of the skills of being a mixologist were lost. And we sort of had to relearn, and we relearned at the time when a lot of pre-mixed drinks were coming onto the market. And so that the skills were really lost, but they're coming back now, like at Pegu Club and elsewhere. It's really nice to see that.
Well, and Wayne, your scholarly articles on rum, your scholarly work on rum, your book is amazing, and we're going to suggest people go out and pick it up, and it's you're doing your part to bring all those things back.
Well, I'm hoping.
Thanks, Wayne.
Thanks so much, Wayne.
The book is End a Bottle of Rum, A History of the New World in 10 Cocktails. You can find out more about it on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. We'll be back in just a minute. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys, stage left in Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick.
You know, before the news, I just alluded to, and we had a break for the news, a dinner, actually, that Francis and I had together in the mid-90s. We went to a restaurant called Alain Ducasse in Paris, which one of the great restaurants of the world.
There's still an Alain Ducasse in Paris, but it's in a different building. It's a different restaurant. Same chef.
Well, one of the highlights, I think, of that lunch, actually, it was a luncheon, that Frances and I had, and something I had never seen before, was Frances and I, that we had a prefix menu, and the dessert was a rum baba, which is a drink, which is a dessert that's finished with
it's
rum.
It's a pastry, basically, soaked in rum at the last minute.
And so when it came time to serve the rumbaba, they brought out the rumbaba, and then they brought over a garadon with, I don't know, 60 rums on it, 50 rums on it, just a tremendous choice of rums. And one of the rums that was available was the JM that Wayne referred to earlier. And actually, that was the rum I chose. It was a vintage dated bottle of JM rum. And how, I mean, it was just special, and it had kind of a dark richness to it. No, like no rum I've had before or since.
You know, in France, the rum is important. We think of it as an island thing, but in French trade, in the French islands, like Martinique, rum is made, and they still have what they call rum agricole, which is like Appalachian wine. It's regulated by the French government, and like a Grand Cru Burgundy or First Growth Bordeaux, you can have certified rum agricole. And these rums are amazing, like you said. But
I was just surprised to see at a great, especially back then, I mean, in the mid-90s when really no one was talking about rum, this restaurant of the you know, one of the top
chefs in the world,
10 restaurants in the world at the time, was showcasing rum as a premium kind of beverage, and very surprising.
All that we've learned since then. Well, I hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to the Restaurant Guys talking about rum. Hope we've made you a little thirsty for this evening. Stay away from that blender. My name is Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.